The aim of Culturico's podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Greetings, everybody. My name is Anthony Ponke, International Relations Editor here at Culturico and Assistant Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State University out here in California. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Pete Simi. He's an Associate Professor of Sociology at Chapman University. Dr. Simi has been studying political extremism with a focus on far-right extremism for the past 25 years. He's the co-author of the book, American Swastika, Inside the White Power Movement's Hidden Spaces of Hate. So, Dr. Simi, thanks for taking the time out to talk with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you today, Anthony.
Yep, should be a great conversation. To start, can you share a little bit what got you interested in this research?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a long story, but just a couple kind of high points in terms of how I guess became sensitized to the issue of extremism at a pretty early age, and in particular, the problem of white supremacy and the extent to which American society is really founded on it. When I was 5 years old, the miniseries Roots aired on national TV. I believe still today it's the most watched TV miniseries in U.S. history. So I watched every night for, I guess it was a 5 or 7 night series, glued to the TV, laying on my living room floor. I can still remember it quite vividly. And frankly, the brutal nature of the topic, obviously chattel slavery and the extent to which, U.S. society was organized around that and how that's illustrated in that miniseries, and viewing that at such an early age and the brutal nature, the beatings, the separation of families, the inhumanity of that system, it made a huge impact on me as a child. And I remember crying at various parts in the miniseries. And so that was a very formative experience for me at a young age. And a number of other things happened in childhood and adolescence that kind of built on that. But when I was in grad school, I started grad school in 1996, shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing. And if you'll recall, at that time, Oklahoma City was the most substantial act of terrorism in our country's history in terms of a single act. Prior to 9/11, 168 American citizens killed in the federal building there in Oklahoma City, the Murrah Building. And I wanted to understand how someone like Tim McVeigh comes to become so immersed in a worldview that he would come to see that kind of violence as necessary, as part of a tactic, a strategy to bring about certain changes within society. And so I decided that to understand how someone becomes a McVeigh, it's important to meet actual people who have this, similar beliefs as McVeigh did. And so I wanted to see if I could make contact with individuals involved, currently involved in different types of far-right extremist groups, white supremacist groups, and so forth. And so I did that in the winter of 97 and spent a number of years doing ethnographic field work with active members of these types of groups, living with them in their homes, attending rallies, Klan, cross burnings, swastika burnings, neo-Nazi music shows, watching parents socialize, their young children into these beliefs, getting, teaching them how to do Nazi salutes at the age of 5, that kind of stuff. And really just trying to understand their world from their perspective, in a natural setting, not in a laboratory, not on a survey. Those are all perfectly appropriate methodologies, but I really wanted to kind of gain that first person, firsthand perspective. More recently, we've been doing intensive life history interviews with former members of different types of right-wing extremist groups, in order to understand their process of getting involved and ultimately how they got out. So it's, you know, it's been, as you mentioned, 25 years doing a number of different types of, you know, studies to try and understand these topics, and you know, still having a lot of questions that you know, I want to further explore.
Wow. And that kind of ethnographic work has had to be, I mean, very intense, that kind of on the ground kind of work. Wow.
It was very difficult, very difficult.
I'm curious. I think one thing, a lot of your work has centered on the United States, as you mentioned, in your field work and so on. I'm just curious, do you see similarities and differences between European style fascism, from, you know, from the 1930s and so on, and more contemporary movements?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. And let me just say at the outset that, you know, making these kind of historical comparisons, you know, across time and place is always complicated. It's tricky. And so we want to be careful and be appropriately nuanced and not just make real rigid blanket statements that this is the same or this is totally different. But I think there are some real important similarities. And I think we can use, you know, we go back to one of the founders of sociology, Emile Durkheim's concept of anomie, normlessness. And we can look at that concept and the extent to which it helps explain the rise of fascism, you know, in the pre-World War II era and what we're seeing today. And I think there is that's a concept that helps us get some kind of grasp on some of the conditions in place, the major structural changes occurring within, for instance, the economy at both times, you know, certain similarities in that respect. And when you have these kind of structural changes, institutional changes, including some interesting similarities in terms of institutional legitimacy, and kind of a crisis of legitimacy within institutions, similarities in that respect. So you've got, I think, some structural similarities in terms of the two time periods across these different geographic locations. But also, I think when we think about structural kind of strains that may be increasing the likelihood of fascist movements being able to gain a grip within society. Also, there's a certain socio-emotional aspect to it that's important not to overlook. And I think we can see some similarities there as well. High levels of resentment, for example, and scapegoating certain populations as being the root of problems, of the tendencies towards conspiratorial explanations, high levels of paranoia, certain kinds of anger that often goes along with resentment. You know, I think we do see some interesting similarities in that respect that cuts across. And one of the things that is so important about history is it provides us with sensitizing kind of understanding. You know, it doesn't necessarily allow us to predict, but it does give us a sensitizing ideas about what to look for and where our, in this case, vulnerabilities might be. And so I think that's an important point of consideration. Of course, I think, you know, those who provide testimony, for instance, Holocaust survivors who talk about some of the things that they perceive as being similar in their experience to what, you know, they're seeing today here in the U.S. as well as across Europe. I mean, that's pretty powerful testimony that certainly should not be discounted either. Mm-hmm.
Do you see any, I mean, differences? I mean, mentioning like there's the historical or the structural, the economic things, the emotional things that you see that go into the movements and forces. But do you see anything that's like, you know, oh, this was, you know, fascism back then and now? There's something here something changed, or can you identify certain differences?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I would say that so much as when we talk about the United States, it does have somewhat of a special case to it in a sense, in part going back to our introduction. The presence of chattel slavery in the United States and the recency, right? I mean, is abolished, you know, just fairly recently from a historical perspective, right? Not that many years ago. Mm-hmm. And that it was built on. So in that, you think about chattel slavery as a type of genocide, right? And it was built on another type of genocide, the slaughter of indigenous people in the American colonies and eventually the United States. And so you have one genocide built on another genocide in very close temporal proximity. And that creates a real powder keg of sorts in many respects for the United States in terms of building a substantial reservoir of, frankly, brutality, sadism, a mean-spiritedness that we've just frankly never come to terms with. And you see that in the way in which we deny history today with the whole controversy around critical race theory and just the inability or the unwillingness and the outright rejection of historical facts under the banner that it's propaganda that's being essentially directed towards white students in particular, making them feel guilty, so forth and so on. To the point of actually, in some cases in Texas, trying to change use of the term slave and replace it with agricultural work. Mm-hmm. And this is the what we're talking about here in terms of the unwillingness to really reckon with the actual history that characterizes the United States. So that I do think that creates some certain kind of, like I said, a special case of sorts that requires some aspects of a unique explanation of sorts.
I think, I'm just thinking about that last point there. There's revisionism. I don't know if you want to call it revisionism, but a certain kind of, there's Holocaust denying all over the place, right? I mean, but you see that the thinking in the United States is somewhat, there's something about, racism, particularly white supremacy, and maybe the violence that's taken place, but there's a kind of like disavowal of it or something that's special.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because if you look at the Lost Cause mythology that really develops after the American U.S. Civil War, right? And this total romanticized version of the Confederacy that gets promulgated initially with Birth of a Nation, this film that sweeps the country, that's essentially a promotion of the Ku Klux Klan's formation and essentially espousing that the Klan saved the former Confederacy from these reckons of the Reconstruction era where white women were being raped by freed slaves and all this propaganda, right? This is a movie that receives national attention, widespread support among the American public. Even President Wilson at the time refers to it as writing history with a lightning rod, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So, at the highest levels, you get support for this movie, The Birth of a Nation. And then you get Birth of a Nation 2.0 with Gone with the Wind,
yeah.
Right? becomes really the leading movie of its time, really, and for decades to come. It's viewed in an uncritical way, largely, despite that, even at the time of Gone with the Wind, there were civil rights activists, primarily African-American, who were critical of the film. But for the most part, it really becomes a version of history that is taught throughout, not just the South, but throughout. As a high school student in the 80s in Washington, as far north as you can get, I was taught certain things that were consistent with the Lost Cause mythology, that Nat Turner was a fanatic. Here's a person trying to essentially find freedom, right, for himself and others in this similar situation in terms of being in bondage. And he's being characterized in the 1980s in high school history textbook as a fanatic, somebody essentially fighting for freedom. So that Lost Cause mythology sweeps American society and promotes a certain version of understanding of U.S. history that's so really at odds with reality. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, if you look at, for instance, the statues issue, having monuments to essentially traitors to the country, right? Folks like General Lee, who, are essentially promoted as heroes. And even folks like General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who ends up becoming the first imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, statues to him, that at least until recently were in public parks in places like Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. That you just don't see that in the post-Nazi era, for instance, right? Mm. There wasn't an equivalent to that in Germany.
Right. Just a minute on that. Like, I wonder, after fascist Germany, you don't have these the Lost Cause, like you mentioned, in like this, those statues that are put up, they're not put up in like 1865 or 1870. Those are built, like in the early 20th century in some cases.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So
like 50 years later, they're paying homage to Confederates and former slave owners, white supremacists, right? You don't have like Hitler statues being built in Germany in 1970, right?
No, right. I mean, that's just, it's almost, I think it's fair to say it's unthinkable.
Mm-hmm, right. So another question is, I mean, you kind of talked about economics and so on, but in terms of causes, can you, in your research, and have you ever come across what can be identified as causes for the presence of right-wing extremism now globally?
Yeah, well, now we get really, it gets really tricky. Because we're talking about trying to identify causal mechanisms that cut across time and space. I think, you know, that gets very complicated. And also we're talking about multiple levels of analysis that we need to take into consideration. So are we talking about individual level? How do individuals become radicalized to the point of where they become committed to a group or the movement more broadly and identify? And are we talking about at the individual level in terms of those who become active versus those who become not only active, but actually violently active in the sense mm-hmm. of, you know, you have a host of folks who are involved in these kind of groups, whether we're talking about the US or Europe. Fortunately, the vast majority aren't directly committing violence themselves. That's a smaller sub, you know, kind of sample or sub portion of the larger kind of number of folks who are involved in these groups or identify with these movements. So, you know, that is, you almost need somewhat of a different explanation for those who commit violence directly versus those who maybe support violence indirectly or are sympathetic towards using violence as a tactic, but aren't actually doing it themselves. So that, you know, and then are we talking about, like I said, individual level? Or are we talking about more at a broader kind of societal level for, you know, the moments in time when these movements seem to you know, be able to gain traction? And so I just think, you know, we do need to be, I think, careful to sort out these different levels of analysis and explanation. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're, you know, going to confine, say, what we've learned about the United States in terms of the individual level, you know, as far as who becomes involved in these groups. You know, one of the things that's interesting that we find is that among our former white supremacists that we've done these really in-depth interviews with. And these are life history interviews where we start with their earliest memories in childhood and we move forward to the present. And, you know, the individuals we're interviewing range in age from, you know, in their 20s to in some cases they're elderly. Mm-hmm. So the interviews are really detailed and they often are, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours in length. And they cover really sensitive issues. And that the one of the advantages of interviewing former members of these groups versus current members, the way I was when I was doing the field work, is that when I was doing field work with active members, I had to be very careful for safety reasons not to make them feel more paranoid than they already felt having me around as a non-member. Yeah. And so asking real sensitive questions was somewhat off the table unless they offered information, you know, whereas with the formers, we've been able to, everything's been kind of an open book. And so we asked, you know, questions like, have they ever been a victim of sexual abuse, physical abuse, you know, during their childhood, adolescence or adult? And so, you know, what we find is during their childhood and adolescence, they're reporting very high levels of trauma of various sorts. Physical abuse, sexual abuse, parental neglect, parental abandonment, all of what are well-identified, known, documented, what we call risk factors or environmental adversities that we know can have neurological consequences in terms of development, certainly social emotional consequences in terms of development, affects a person's self-image, you know, affects a whole host of different aspects of a person's life to have these kinds of traumatic experiences, especially, you know, chronic and intense ones that occur over, you know, longer periods of time during childhood and adolescence. And we're finding that they're reporting very high levels of these. And we think this is an important piece of the puzzle in that while most people who have these experiences don't go on to become involved in these kind of extremist movements, it still is kind of helpful in understanding them becoming more susceptible to the messages of these groups. And these groups do a good job of creating certain kind of propaganda narratives around why people may have certain problems in their lives and that these movements provide explanations for why those problems exist. So for a person who's feeling, you know, angry, resentful, frustrated based on certain life experiences, is looking for answers, and then encounters, this movement either, offline or now more recently, digitally online, encounter, even just the narratives doesn't even encounter the movement. Just the narratives sometimes are what stick for a person. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. And then they begin to explore on their own more and start to look into this, and they may fall, further down that rabbit hole, so to speak. So that's one facet of it, but that's just one facet of it.
Yeah. I was thinking of, I'm thinking that individual piece is super key. And I'm just wondering how it connects to, or if it does connect to certain larger political economic things. I'm thinking actually of Steve Bannon. I think, Steve Bannon, who worked for the Trump administration, then he did this, I don't know what you want to call it, organizing, he did this world tour, went to Europe and organized folks there on the right. And I remember him saying, I think it was some interview, he said something like, it was 2008 or 2007, 2008, the financial crisis hits, and you know what happened? Nothing. Or rather, the corporations aren't held accountable. And so he kind of identifies these, at least one of the things that he identifies is like this economic shock, but how the shock wasn't really dealt with. And that kind of triggered people to tend towards, I don't know, what does he calls, he's had a lot of terms for for the organizations. He says like, nationalist populism or whatever. But I mean, I'm just curious, how do you see that kind of larger political event?
Yeah, well, I think it's super important. And it doesn't have to be, it's not exclusive to economic transformations, but it can be political transformation, be cultural transformation, demographic transformations. Sometimes I think get a little bit stuck on just economics. Obviously economics are important, and that's there's no doubt about that. But sometimes I think we get stuck on that, and then it creates kind of a false sense, I would say, to some extent, that these movements primarily appeal to those that are suffering economically. And you see that explanation offered a lot, but the empirical data suggests otherwise, that these movements are not exclusively appealing to people that are on the lower end of the socioeconomic status ladder. So that these kind of movements have really broad-based appeals, and you find people across the socioeconomic spectrum who are interested and attracted to these kind of movements. And part of the reason for that is that these movements do have an economic basis to a lot of the arguments that they make, but they also, I think, really primarily are focused on identity issues. Mm. And even the economic issues have oftentimes are kind of converted into an identity issue narrative that the movements kind of promote. And so really, I think because they are focused so heavily on identity, that can appeal, to a large spectrum of the population.
Yeah, like immigration, right? There's something about international, but transcontinental. I mean, something that you talk about demographic changes and so on, but they can be a trigger. I mean, Europe and the United States, right?
Absolutely. And that can be, that can be kind of translated into economic arguments, but it can be translated into cultural arguments that this large influx of immigrants are going to change our culture, right? Mm. Not just that they're going to steal our jobs, but they're going to change our culture. They're going to change our way of life. And even to demographics, the argument, the so-called replacement theory, which is essentially an extension of what's called white genocide. And that's this idea that essentially the white race is going to cease to exist. And it's happening for a variety of reasons. One of which, though, is that so-called non-white immigrant populations are replacing whites in traditionally white nations. And that, some people might say, well, that sounds, white genocide sounds pretty fantastic. But we have to keep in mind that the idea of white genocide is a long-held belief that's motivated large cross sections of white population. So in the United States, it was to a large extent the motivation for the eugenics movement was motivated on the principle or the idea that essentially the white race, was faced with potential extinction if certain measures weren't put in place. And of course, Nazi Germany is very much predicated on some version of a fear of white genocide. So, that idea may sound kind of fringy, but historically it's not fringe at all. Mm-hmm.
There's that point on biology. There seems to be something there's identity, which is cultural, but there's this also how it relates back to, it's not, the eugenic stuff like you're mentioning. That's something I think people think of associating that, like you're saying, with Nazi Germany, but you know, there was sterilization and all this stuff in the United States for decades, right? Connected to some kind of biological sense of good and bad, right?
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, right? Nazi Germany, Hitler was impressed with the eugenics movement in the United States, and many of the architects of Nazi Germany, the leaders of Nazi Germany were well aware of what was happening. They were also impressed with Jim Crow segregation as well. Mm. And some of the legal aspects of that in particular. Mm. So, we helped influence Nazi Germany by our own policies and practices in the United States that preceded Nazi Germany. Well, I just got to point out, going back to the white genocide not being exclusively fringe, we do have people in Congress today that, as we speak, are promoting essentially some version of white genocide. So, so we just got to get over this idea that what we're talking about is a fringe issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think mentioning Congress people and also that we're talking about is not fringe. Like, how do you see, or in your research and anywhere, like how do you see folks on the right mobilizing? Like, I know a lot of people talk about social media. Do you think that's overhyped, or basically how do people, far right extremism, how do folks mobilize?
Well, I think one of the strengths of far right mobilization is they're quite pragmatic in many respects. I think sometimes we think of them as being, very rigid ideologically, and there is some aspect of that that's certainly the case, but they turn out to be very pragmatic in terms of mobilizing and being very adept at seeing new sources of mobilization. So when you look at, for instance, computer technology, we're looking at electronic bulletin boards back in the 1980s, that earliest precursor to what ends up becoming, the internet forums and that like. The electronic bulletin boards were heavily utilized by white supremacists, folks like Tom Metzger, Louis Beam, and many other leaders of the white supremacist movement were promoting the use of electronic bulletin boards and were, in fact, using those. Mm. The white supremacist movement early on recognizes the internet, and you have folks like Don Black, who founded Stormfront in the mid-1990s, and that becomes the largest white supremacist web forum for white supremacists across the globe, really, for a period of time. You definitely see far-right mobilization using lots of different strategies and tactics. Certainly, social media today is one of the major ones, but it's not exclusive to that. They've done an effective job at utilizing music as a source of propaganda to recruit and organize, geared towards young people for certain genres of music, but then having a broad base of different genres of music that would appeal to other segments, primarily the white population that they're trying to target. Mm-hmm. You see the use of different types of propaganda in terms of leafleting and local kind of more grassroots organizing, focusing on school boards, for example. You see the far right's been very effective at doing that kind of organizing, recognizing that sometimes the biggest change happen, in these kernels, small kinds of efforts at the local level. And then, you start piecing this together over time and you start to have some pretty major influence in many respects. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's very broad based. I don't think social media is overhyped per se, but I do think we have to be careful about how we characterize the influence of social media, especially on at the individual level, and not kind of overgeneralize that influence.
What about violence? How do you see violence? What role does violence play in mobilization?
I think for the far right, it's central. Violence is very much at the core. And it serves a lot of different purposes. In many respects, it can be an organizing principle that's used to help bring people together to coalesce around violence. It's used to intimidate those that they oppose. It's used to symbolically send messages, again, to each other, but also to the world writ large. It can be used to help essentially create a sense of panic and really help corrode the system. So they have this term accelerationism, which is essentially any act of violence is a good act of violence from this philosophy or this standpoint. And the idea is that you don't even have to have a symbolically rich target. Just going out and committing violence is helping bring the system down, helping collapse the system. Mm-hmm. For a long time, they've promoted what they call lone actor. Well, they call it lone wolf terrorism, but essentially it's a single individual who goes out and commits, you know, targeted violence of some kind. It can't be a link to a broader group of people or a broader organization. So it's strategically very effective in that respect. And oftentimes it's not even perceived as terrorism. It may be perceived as kind of generic violence. But the idea with the strategy is that if you're going out and committing violence in the name of the movement doesn't get blamed for the violence per se. And yet the violence can still have the certain kinds of consequences, which is essentially helping destabilize society. You know, there's just lots of different types of violence. Sometimes it's a group based, sometimes it's a single individual, sometimes it's mass casualty violence, sometimes it's interpersonal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it comes in a lot of kind of shapes and sizes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you see, because you mentioned, you know, on the one hand, you mentioned like mobilizing at the school board, or, you know, at the local level. I imagine going to city council meetings or something, you know, very stuff where you probably would not think about using violence. And then you're talking about bombs or something. Or I don't know. But how do you see violence in elections, or how do you see the relationship?
Yeah, well, again, this goes to that, where I mentioned this very pragmatic, is that we've got to do what works. Sometimes what works is presenting a front that is, you know, we're part of the political mainstream. We're just trying to promote, you know, this kind of very non-confrontational agenda. We're really kind of trying to, what they call, infiltrate the system, right? And so if you're going to try and infiltrate the system, then you have to, you know, cover things, right? You have to present yourself in certain ways that, you know, you're not going to stick out like a sore thumb. Yeah. And then other times, you know, what works is for individuals to stick out like a sore thumb and, you know, engage in violence. So the way I see the thread that connects them is it's based on the logic of we need to be multifaceted and use different strategies and different tactics, but the end result is to be effective, mm-hmm. right? And is to essentially transform society. Well, it's to prevent society from becoming a multicultural democracy. So that's right. That's the end goal. So some people say, well, we've got to essentially tear the system down in order to prevent that from happening so that we can essentially create, you know, out of the ashes, create a fascist system. Mm-hmm. Other folks are saying, well, okay, we can stem the tide of the transition to a multicultural democracy by using more institutional means. And so we need to do that as well. Maybe it comes to a full collapse of the system and we'll be prepared when that comes. And so that's why you have lots of stockpiling of weapons. Mm-hmm. You have this kind of quote unquote doomsday prepping, which is part of the kind of preparation, because the idea is at some point, you know, this institutional effort, it will only go so far and there will be a major confrontation of sorts.
Mm-hmm. We need to get seeds and food and our bunkers ready, right? That's the idea.
Yeah, that's on the back burner. Meanwhile, we'll do what we can with the school boards.
This point on pragmatism, do you see that? I mean, again, when we're returning to historical international discussion, is that pragmatism something you would think is new or newish in the last 20, 30 years that the far right has embraced? Or is that something that's kind of always been there?
I think it's more part of their DNA. So I don't think it's so much new. And you know, far right in many respects is it's a social movement that comes from the system, right? It's not from outside the system saying we need to transform the system. It you know, if we look at, you know, Western societies in general and US in particular as being a system where white supremacy is very much a central current within that, you know, social system, and has been from the beginning, right? It's built into it's baked into the cake, as they say, right? It's part of the air that we breathe. It's built into the institutions and so forth. Mm. So then movements that reflect that really are part of the system in a way that's a little bit different, I think, than say a left-wing movement that's really saying there's something wrong with the system. It's unequal, it's unfair, and it needs to be, you know, kind of addressed in that manner. And, you know, the degree of change is going to vary from one movement to the next on the left, you know, and the tactics to create that change, but essentially trying to make the system more equitable, mm-hmm. right, from the outside in a way. Whereas with the far right, it's essentially defending the system's inequity and saying we're trying to prevent the system from becoming more equitable. Mm-hmm. And so again, that it may vary in terms of some folks saying, look, we're just going to collapse the system completely to prevent that from happening and build a new fascist, an entirely fascist system, mm-hmm. versus others, you know, who are trying to prevent that transformation that essentially left-wing movements are trying to bring about.
Yeah.
So, but it has a relationship to the system that I think is different than left-wing movements.
Yeah.
So that's why I get a little nervous when, I get a little nervous when people say left-wing extremism and right-wing extremism are essentially flip sides of the same coin. I just don't think that's quite accurate in terms of the history of left-wing activism versus right-wing activism. Mm. Those are different histories, different relationships to the system. Mm.
Do you see it hinging on that question of equality?
I do, because if you look at left-wing movements, by and large, that's the central premise, is that we want a system that's more equitable. We want environmental justice. We want social justice, race, ethnicity, worker justice, right, in terms of socioeconomic justice. All of those are essentially premised on the idea of equality of some kind, rights for animals, you know, in terms of animal rights movements. It's a similar kind of logic that cuts across what are very different movements in many respects, but it's the central thread is quite similar. Whereas the right is about dispossession. It's about dehumanization, right? It's about saying some people deserve and some people don't. It's about survival of the fittest. Yeah. I mean, really, the central thread for the far right and right wing movements more broadly is an embracing vision of society that's premised on social Darwinism, survival of the fittest. Some people deserve and some people don't. Whether it's the poor versus the rich, whether it's white race versus black race or people of color more broadly, whether it's abled versus disabled. I mean, you pick your, you know, whatever dichotomy. For them, there's deserving and undeserving.
Yeah. Okay. And another thing here is that how do we think about resistance, ways to challenge the right? What do you see as working? What doesn't work?
Yeah. I mean, this is a huge question. And I think we need to be as pragmatic as they are in many respects. One of the first things we got to do a better job of increasing awareness about this. That started to change in the last few years. I've noticed a lot more awareness around these issues than say just even, you know, 5 to 10 years ago. You know, I think we are still suffering from major deficits in awareness. So we're starting to see more awareness. That's because it's hard to mount responses more broadly if there's a lack of awareness. So that really is a critical issue. You know, I think there needs to be continued efforts in terms of promoting movements and agendas that are not strictly responsive to the right. In other words, that have a vision of society that's not solely reactive. Okay. So that's, I think, because if we're only reacting to the far right, then that becomes kind of a feedback loop of sorts that in some ways actually helps them, because especially depending on what the reaction is, some of that can, they actually use to their advantage. So in other words, developing really solid resource infrastructure for movements that are promoting this alternate kind of vision for society that stands on its own. I think that's critical. I think, you know, we need to continue, though, to shed light on the way in which these movements are, for instance, the infiltration within law enforcement, the way in which law enforcement essentially acts as a safe haven for white supremacy. And I use the word infiltration, but with the idea in mind that, you know, white supremacy is at the core of the history of policing in the United States. So that's embedded. And so whatever changes have occurred over that history, we still need to be aware of that extent to which it can, you know, serve as a safe haven. And then we also need to be aware of the actual intentional strategy that white supremacists have been promoting for decades. For their members to gain positions in the law enforcement. So more attention and effort to really uncover that. And same thing with the military issue. Military. So, that, you know, there's a lot of so many different facets of this that we need to be focused on specific issues like that, but then also promoting movements that are essentially helping move society in this kind of transformative way that essentially the far right's trying to prevent.
Yeah, thinking of what you were saying earlier about fringe, that far right is not a fringe, you know, or not a fringe, what do you say, fringe movement, or because I think sometimes maybe for folks who are, you know, maybe watch the news a bit but are not super connected, they may see, you know, oh, there's somebody with a swastika armband. You see them with a five people in the street, and it's like, who are, you know, you don't see them that often. But like what you're saying is there's ways that you mentioned infiltration. There of course there's folks like that, but then there's other folks. I mean, there's gradations. I don't know if that's the right term, but gradations of far right extremism that's present in all kinds of ways, right?
Yeah, I think that was the, you know, hopefully one of the takeaways for January 6th, the you know, attempted insurrection in D.C., is that, you know, one of the reactions was, well, these people can't be extremists or terrorists because they don't look like extremists or terrorists. And that's the wrong response. Because extremism and terrorism aren't about what a person looks like. Just because they look like your next door neighbor doesn't mean they don't believe in certain things that are essentially, you know, the equivalent of what, you know, we define as extremism or terrorism. And we can debate about what's the definition of extremism or terrorism. But when you're trying to, you know, overtake the Capitol, hopefully we can agree that that's an act of extremism or terrorism. And the fact that a person looks like your next door neighbor really shouldn't matter. But that's your point about the gradations of this kind of far right extremism is that it can look in very different ways. It's not just the person with the shaved head or white sheet or swastika tattoo on their forehead. That's one very small segment of what we're talking about. And two is that the types, again, going back to the tactics and strategies being very broad based, is that it can take, you know, lots of different forms. And the message isn't necessarily going to be about white supremacy. In fact, oftentimes it's not. It's not about race at all. It may be very much about the deep state, for example, right? The way in which QAnon has manifested itself and really taken hold to a really eye-opening extent in terms of, we're talking about millions of people who on some level are kind of adherents of QAnon. It's not talking about things the way you might expect the far right to talk. I mean, in some respects it is, but we should be clear that, for instance, the anti-Semitic tropes are very present in QAnon. You know, sometimes it's more coded and other times it's not. I mean, when they talk about Rothschilds, what they're talking about is the international Jew, right? So, you know, sometimes, you know, people may or may not be aware of that kind of coding, but it's very much a part of the narratives that QAnon's created really tried to promote their agenda around. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've touched on a lot of stuff. I mean, a bit about history, some, you know, kind of international comparisons and so on, tactics. I don't know, is there something else? Is there any take home points or anything?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we have covered a lot of grounds and hopefully it was, you know, informative on some level. And just, I would say, as far as take home points are that you know, if people think January 6th was an end point, then they're deluding themselves. That January 6th is the beginning, not the end. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to need a lot of vigilance in terms of how to address this problem. And there's not a single solution, right? It's got to be a multifaceted approach to address the extent to which right, far right movements have a stranglehold, to be quite frankly, frank about it. It's not a foothold. It's a stranglehold in the United States right now and many places in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, a lot of folks got their work cut out for them, I suppose you could say.
Yes, agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Pete Seamy. I think we'll have this up on the Culto Rico website. And until another time, everybody take care.
Thank you for listening. This episode of Culto Rico was produced by Anthony Panky. If you want to read our latest articles on science and culture, you can find them at cultorico.com. To get our latest episodes, subscribe to Culto Rico on your podcast platform of choice. If you like what we do, feel free to give us a review or spread the word. Thank you, and until next time.